Hey, this is Michelle Dawson, and I need to update my disclosure statements. So my non-financial disclosures, I actively volunteer with Feeding Matters, National Foundation of Swallowing Disorders, NFOSD, Dysphagia Outreach Project, DOP. I am a former treasurer with the Council of State Association Presidents, CSAP, a past president of the South Carolina Speech, Language, and Hearing Association, SCISHA, a current Board of Trustees member with the Communication Disorders Foundation of Virginia, and I am a current member of ASHA, ASHA SIG 13, SCISHA, the Speech Language Hearing Association of Virginia, SHAV, a member of the National Black Speech Language Hearing Association in BOSLA, and Dysphagia Research Society, DRS. My financial disclosures include receiving compensation for First Bite Podcast from SpeechTherapyPD.com, as well as from additional webinars and for webinars associated with Understanding Dysphagia, which is also a podcast with SpeechTherapyPD.com. And I currently receive a salary from the University of South Carolina in my work as adjunct professor and student services coordinator, and I receive royalties from the sale of my book, Chasing the Swallow: Truth, Science, and Hope for Pediatric Feeding and Swallowing Disorders, as well as compensation for the CEUs associated with it from SpeechTherapyPD.com. So those are my current disclosure statements. Thanks, guys.
Hi, this is Erin Forward, and these are my disclosure statements. I receive a salary from Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center. I receive royalties from Speech Therapy PD for my work with First Bite Podcast and other presentations. I also receive payment for sales from the First Bite Boutique, which I have with Michelle Dawson. For non-financial disclosures, I am a member of ASHA and a member of Special Interest Group 13. I also am a volunteer for Feeding Matters. I am a contributor for the book Chasing the Swallow with Michelle Dawson, which I receive no financial gain. I also am a member of the South Carolina Coalition Committee with ICDL-DIF for a time.
All right, everybody. I am here with none other than the Sparkles themselves, and they're not only the kindest, most compassionate women, but they're also brilliant leaders in our field. And I am so honored to have none other than Dr. Kelly Farquharson and Dr. Jennifer Simpson. And they're here. So ladies, please introduce yourselves and tell us a little bit about yourselves. And then y'all, we are going to spend the next hour myth busting on conventions, because honestly, I don't like the things I see in the world about nepotism and favoritism and all these terrible, horrible things, when truly our conventions are moments of joy. So that's where we're going with this. But yes, please feel free to introduce yourself. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having us. Do you want me to go first, Jen?
Yes.
Okay. Well, thank you, Michelle, for inviting us to do this. We were very excited. We were texting, you know, in advance of this, just sharing how excited we are to be back together, because Jen and I have spent a lot of time over the past 2 years together. And so being back together is very exciting. I'm Kelly Farquharson. So I served as the ASHA convention co-chair for speech language pathology for the 2023 convention in Boston, which was in November of 2023, and was a whirlwind of joy, I will say. I agree with your description there, Michelle. I'm an associate professor at Florida State University, and I direct the Children's Literacy and Speech Sound or Class Lab. And the mission of my lab is to help children with speech and language impairments achieve classroom success. So a lot of the work that we do is surrounding supporting kids who have speech and language impairments, specifically with classroom skills like reading and spelling, but also accurate speech production, good language, and also then supporting all the educators who offer their time and love and dedication to helping those kids. So classroom teachers, special education teachers, SLPs, that's really a lot of the work that we do. So I've been an SLP for 19 years. And I just love the field. I'm actually fresh out right now of my clinical phonetics course that I teach here at Florida State. I teach at 8 a.m. Tuesday, Thursday. So I just am fresh from that class. And that's my main area of teaching and research, is phonetics and speech sound disorders. And those are areas that I just love in our field. So I do a lot of promotion about that on Instagram. My account is @classlab_Kelly. And I have a weekly series called Phonetics Friday, where we just nerd out about phonetics every Friday.
I gotta say, y'all, it's completely clinically applicable. So this is not research that's isolated. You can read her articles and their actual how to implement it. And her work is completely functional because you just did the one on training parapros on how to do like joint reading activities for literacy language acquisition. And y'all, it's amazing. So
thanks so much. We do try. It's hard sometimes, you know, but we do try to do that. So thank you.
Yes. And then Jen, hi.
Hi, Michelle. Thanks for having us. I agree with Kelly. The ASHA convention was a whirlwind. It went by so fast after so many years of planning together. And we were joking just right before we started that we have withdrawals from each other because we don't have to talk every single day or every single hour any longer. Although, you know, I'd like to. So I am a clinical professor and associate head at Purdue University. I was the co-chair of audiology, so I'm a trained audiologist, and most of my day spent is training graduate students in audiology at Purdue and creating clinical experiences and innovative experiences for those students so that they become the best audiologists out there. I had to do the math after Kelly said her years. I've been an audiologist for 27 years now.
Amazing.
It's crazy to me. I didn't know what I wanted to do going back to the beginning question you asked, like how we became speech pathologists or audiologists. But I spent 6 years in undergrad because I just didn't know what to do. And then finally, in my fourth year, I took an audiology undergrad course and then I was there. And along the way, collected some minors. So, yeah. So yes, here we are.
Yeah,
I love that. I triple minored. It was history, art history, and special education because I got so into the history, but I paired the art history classes with it because the art told the messages of the time. And I was like, Dad, maybe I want to go back to be an art historian. And he was like, so no. Like, hard no. I was like, okay, yes, sir. But okay, now you omitted one very large, cool hat that you wear. You're CAPSID president.
That's right. So I just looked at this. I'm halfway through the CAPSID presidency year. You know, it's a 3-year term, president-elect, president, and past president. So I've been proud of all of the work that CAPSID's been doing. And we're actually meeting next week for a face-to-face meeting in San Antonio. So getting prepared for that and looking forward to that. And then of course, very much looking forward to the annual convention in April in New Orleans.
Yes.
Okay. I'll be there.
Okay, good, Kelly.
Yes.
I will miss y'all, but I'm going to Mbazla, which is like a week later. So yes. The balance. But okay, so folks, if you're listening and you don't know what CAPSID is, correct me when I mispronounce it. It's the Council of Academic Programs for Communication Sciences and Disorders.
Yeah, you got it.
I went clinical first because we're clinic, right? Right.
Yeah.
But y'all, this is the body of leaders in our academic fields that address the needs of both the audiology and the speech language pathology programs and give us guiding policy, guiding literature and resources. And trust me, I know that they hear the need for neurodiversity affirming movements. I know that they hear the need for DEIA because the tutorials and webinars that have been created for faculty over the last couple of years demonstrate this. They've had mini series on interprofessional education for interprofessional practice across the life continuum and settings. And I've witnessed it and it's been beautiful. So there's... Yeah. So thank you, because I know that you had a lot to do with that. So is that a fair summation of CAPSID?
Very good. Yeah. So our mission is to, you know, support CSD programs nationally. There's about 350 programs nationally and internationally that belong and, you know, be the leading resource for leaders in our field in academia.
Awesome. There it is. All right. Well, we have a lot of ground to cover in limited time frame, but November was igniting innovation. That was the theme that y'all came up with, which is kind of a process in and of itself. But so how did we look? Do we have a final headcount, so to speak?
Kelly, you want me to take that one?
Yeah, go ahead.
Sure. In person, we had 14,446 and virtual only participants was almost 1,500.
Oh, that's amazing. Those numbers, did they go up?
that's about what we were expecting, about 15,000 people, you know, recovering from the COVID years and just travel and, you know, all of the kind of challenges it is to get to conventions sometimes. But we are really, really happy with those numbers. And it's definitely going up the last couple of years.
I think the biggest ASHA convention we ever had was ASHA 2018, also in Boston. And that was over 18,000, maybe almost 19,000, very close. So although I had very unrealistic hopes that we would beat that number and that this would be the biggest ASHA, I was also very realistic that, you know, the ASHA 2020 convention was canceled. 2021 was in DC and there was about 5,000 people in person. ASHA 2022 was in New Orleans and that was about 10,000 people. So I thought realistically, you know, another 5,000 to that would show some nice progression. And that's exactly where we landed, which is really exciting to see.
Yeah, that's awesome. I will also be honest, the 18,000, I was there, that was a little claustrophobic.
So,
that's, I love you people, but that's a lot of humans in one little space. Yeah.
Happy lines alone were things I never want to relive.
My favorite was ASHA in LA. It was when the bathroom signs were changing. So I waited. This was prior to enrolling in pelvic floor therapy. So I waited in line for what I thought was the unisex bathroom. And I waited and I waited and I waited only to find out it was the elevator sign.
Oh no.
Run so far. Luckily, the next bathroom that I found, there was a bunch of more senior gray-haired women in line. And I was like, look, I got to go now or we're going to have a situation. And that was literally my, here's your sign to start pelvic floor therapy. Whenever we go back to LA, I will be sure to learn my signs, but the things that happen. Oh,
yes.
Do we have any breakdown on the numbers of audiology attendants versus SLPs? And have we started collecting data on like SLPA attendance? Because that's a new exciting cert.
Yeah, so we do. We asked yesterday to make sure we were accurate on our numbers. You know, the audiology attendance is always a bit or a lot lower than the SLP just because of the nature of our fields. But it was about 70% SLP attendance, about 4% audiology, and then 25% like other. Either they didn't identify themselves or they were an assistant or they just put related professional there.
Or student. That could be student too.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Mm-hmm. But also we had so many interprofessional practice partners there this year. That was phenomenal to see that metrics. But it's lovely to hear that we had audiologists present. That's exciting. I truly feel two steps removed from collaborating with audiologists because, I mean, we don't do too much when we're focusing on feeding and swallowing. So, but I mean, sometimes there's comorbid issues and then we'll intersperse, but it makes me admire those that get to engage more, if that makes sense. Okay, so this is where we have to tiptoe into more of the behind the scenes stuff. There is so many countless hundreds of thousands of hours, not hundreds of thousands, but hundreds or thousands of hours that you two alone have put into leading this in conjunction with the ASHA staff that you get to know very, very well. But can you kind of describe maybe big picture the steps that go into making sure that this is a success and people walk away feeling hopeful about their profession again?
That's a big one. I think, you know, one thing is really understanding the timeline of all of this, which I think can be helpful to kind of get the full context. And then the other part I'll talk about, and maybe Jen will talk about too, is kind of the development of the theme, which I think is really getting at the latter part of your question, which is really re-inspiring and reigniting people's passion for their chosen profession. And so I think the first part is like Jen and I both, we applied to do this role of convention co-chair. So it is an application process that requires, you know, a letter of intent with three letters of recommendation. It's reviewed by the Scientific and Professional Education Board, SPEB at ASHA. And that happens 2 years in advance. So we were selected for this in the summer of 2021 for a convention that was going to take place in November of 2023. So with respect to the time investment, it is easily a two and a half year commitment. And in some parts of that, we weren't as active as other parts. Sometimes it felt like a second, like a part-time job. Sometimes it felt like, you know, a small service contribution, you know, so it ebbed and flowed as the workload ebbed and flowed. I think one of the most special parts of it for me was, in addition to obviously working with and partnering with Jen, was the development of the convention program committee, because that's the heart of it all. These are the people like yourself, Michelle, who drive the content. So you, along with your committee, the topic chairs, are determining what topics need to be invited. What do we really want to spotlight this year? So as much as part of me feels like, you know, that there's some credit that's due to me and Jen for that to a certain extent in terms of having built the convention program committee, it's really the topic chairs that drive that. That's a huge part. And that's where I think that responsibility and that service opportunity is just so important, because you can really shape the experience for people who are in your sub-discipline. And so by that, I mean, you know, pediatric feeding and swallowing for you, Michelle, or mine is speech sound disorders. And, you know, there's literacy and school age language, and there's a variety of audiology subtopics. So, you know, really thinking about how you can shape the biggest professional development event of our profession annually with who you invite and what gets accepted. And I think that that's a huge task, and one that I'm super proud of how we, you know, ended up employing. I just think it was a really nice execution of that work, but it takes a long time. And so we were, you know, 2.5 years in. And so our kickoff meeting took place in September of 2022. So 2 months before the 2022 convention, which was still a year out from our own convention, right? So we're now, like, you know, 15 months ahead, and we had an in-person meeting in Boston. And that's where we really got to do some of the nuts and bolts work with our topic chairs. We had already selected our topic chairs at this point, and we really got to work on thinking about the theme. And I think that theme of igniting innovation, I loved the theme so much. I thought it really brought to life what we wanted to showcase, which was kind of this point in our field where we are of, we're needing to be innovators, and that's a hard job sometimes. And we also wanted people who are at various stages and in various work settings to feel like innovators. So innovation is not just AI and fancy technology and the latest cutting edge research and facial transplants and really wild aspects of our field. Innovation happens in public schools, in a group therapy setting with first graders and third graders who all have different speech and language goals. That's innovation too. Making that therapy session work takes innovation. And so we wanted everyone who is in attendance to feel like an innovator and to really help ignite that for them. And so our theme, because we landed on something so strong, I think that allowed us to shape a really powerful convention. I saw the topic chairs take that theme and run with it. It was so cool. The ASHA staff who you mentioned, who I just cannot say enough about, hopefully we'll spend a little bit of extra time just shouting them out, because they're all incredible. The things they put together, like that light up sign that was in the exhibit hall for everyone to take pictures in front of, the igniting innovation sign. I mean, that was all them. Everyone took it and ran with it. And it was very exciting to be part of developing that.
So I'll just add a couple things about the theme. I think developing the theme was one of the most exciting parts. Doing that together, bouncing ideas off each other, coming up with kind of wild ideas, but then reining them in. And right, Kelly? And
oh, yeah.
I think Kelly and I both wanted the theme to be, like she said, a strong theme that people could connect to and know that that's what the convention was about, and could tie whatever they were doing to that theme so that it was for everyone. And, you know, we often said in meetings, like, put the I in innovation, like the person innovation. And even in some of the visuals, there's a person in the middle of igniting innovation on the ASHA branding, which is just subtle, but like it meant a lot to Kelly and I, because that was our goal, is to make everyone feel like they were part of the theme. The other thing we wanted to do with the theme was just move away, or move forward, I suppose, from kind of the COVID feeling everyone had. And all of the talk about, like, be flexible, you know, you need to be
resilient.
You need to be resilient. Like, we were hearing people were tired of being told that anymore. It's like, I have been, I am, I will be. Like, let's move on to something kind of dream bigger, you know? So we were really proud of all of that. And then the other fun part about the theme, I thought was fun, was creating the visual of it and the colors and like all the sparkles. And Kelly, do you remember like the first ones just were not like what we had thought? Like they weren't sparkly enough. They weren't eye-catching enough. Like we wanted them to be like people would recognize it. And so I thought that that turned out so pretty with the navy blue background and then all the kind of the rainbow sparkles everywhere. So
I mean, y'all sequins dresses were kind of like on point. And I definitely wore sequins on my shoes, my tennis shoes. Yes, I have sequin tennis shoes if you're listening, because you need sequin tennis shoes in your life. But that was my sparkle contribution.
Yes, we exchanged many text messages about the dresses. There was, that was months and months and months of text exchanges.
Kelly, I haven't fretted over a dress ever as much as I did with you. So.
Yep, same.
Folks tuned in for behind the convention details, and inevitably we're like, but the dress.
Oh my gosh.
Okay, so folks, here's where it kind of looks like when you get asked to serve as the topic chair, you have this kickoff meeting and you're surrounded and you sit in awe, because all of a sudden, I know me personally, I was sitting in this room full of brilliant, compassionate minds, right? And you get a handbook, and it's essentially your how to plan a convention Bible, for lack of a better phrase. And I'm not trying to be blasphemous, but that's kind of what it reminded me of. Wait, y'all, you know Marie Ireland, right? She made the VDOE SLP Bible, and I started out in the public schools, and I still have my original blue one in that cabinet like 20 years later, but that's what it reminded me of. But we have to sit down with our essentially creating what I call my council of elders, right? Like with my team. And we assess our topic descriptions. We assess what guidance to give, so that if you're listening and you're like, hey, I've got this really great new innovative therapeutic approach, or I've got this killer research in this area, well, then you can get on Ash's website and find these topic descriptions to say, it fits here. It would fit nicely here. But that is a significant body of work to annually update this, because if we didn't, our field would never move forward, right? So that's kind of like the first leg, is the topic chair creates their committee, and then we go through this document, and then we start getting into the nitty-gritty planning. Now, what I honestly didn't anticipate, and this is something that y'all can enlighten, is there's so much confusion amongst ASHA members that think these topic committees are just microcosms of their affiliate SIGs. And they're not. Those are totally separate entities. So could you maybe illuminate that piece?
Sure. Well, I can talk about it a little bit. And then Jen, obviously correct me if I'm wrong or weigh in. But so I think one thing to remember is the number of topics is far greater than the number of SIGs. So there were 31 topic areas in the 2023 ASHA convention. That's not a static number. For the reasons that you just said, Michelle, every year we look to see what needs to be added, changed. I mean, at one point in time, like long ago, research was its own topic.
Oh my God.
Each topic was not necessarily infused with research, right? That's so this grows and evolves as our field does. So sometimes there are more than 31 topics, and sometimes there are fewer, as some need to maybe be combined to better reflect how the field has changed and what ASHA members need. So I think that's one thing. And then as far as SIGs, they're now 20. So there's not a direct one-to-one correspondence between the number of topics and the number of SIGs. So they don't really fit inside of one another. There's also, in most cases, completely separate committees, not necessarily intentionally. Sometimes there's overlap, but it's usually not the case that the people who comprise, you know, SIG 1, which is pretty broad, language learning and education, are not necessarily, and usually not at all, the same people who comprise a topic like school age language and learning, which has some overlap, but is not exactly the same topic. The school age language one is is about school age language, but it is pretty restricted to, you know, school age. So there's a limitation in the age of the kid that we talk about, whereas SIG 1 is more lifespan language learning. So there's a lot of variability there. I don't really see them as really similar at all, especially because we have a separate SIG affiliation process where the ASHA SIGs can work with different topics and they can decide to kind of quote unquote align with a certain topic for that convention and work together to build some sessions. But there's variability, and those SIGs have full autonomy of which topics they partner with and how that all works. And so an example of that could be, you know, SIG 13 is swallowing, and that SIG does not necessarily have to align with the topic of either adult swallowing or pediatric feeding. They can align with cleft palate, craniofacial. They can align with speech sound disorders. You know, there's often an overlap. They can align with health literacy. They can align with any topic they want. So there's not necessarily, even the ones that do have a little bit more of a one-to-one correspondence, kind of the swallowing or a hearing one, or one that is more craniofacial or global issues, there still does not need to be a connection between that SIG and that topic for the convention. That SIG has full autonomy to align with any topic they want. So that's, I think, one part of it. And then if really just looking at all of the committees, the names should be available on the ASHA website. And so any member can easily look to see that maybe there's one member that overlaps. I mean, that might be purposeful so that that SIG is well represented, but it's completely different groups of people. Now, we're a small field. And so the number of people who are experts in speech sound disorders such that they can serve on the speech sound disorders topic, you know, sometimes there is a little bit more overlap in certain sub-disciplines because there's just so few people who have that expertise, and pair that with the interest in serving. So sometimes there is overlap, but that's never intentional. And they really, they coexist, but, and there's kind of a natural overlap, but they really are separately autonomous bodies.
Yes. Yes. I fielded that question a lot over the last year. And then another thing that I really appreciated was in that initial meeting, y'all laid the groundwork that when we're forming our committees, we also need to elevate new voices, diverse voices, and not just when you encourage diverse, it was not just in our cultural backgrounds and linguistic backgrounds and what we're bringing to the table, but also our settings, and pulling in the clinic piece. And Jen, I mean, you're in the clinic, so you inbreed that part, but like pulling in clinicians as well as researchers and making sure we also mentored students.
Yeah, I can speak to that for a second. Kelly and I talked about this a lot, you know, pre-planning, like when we knew we were going to be co-chairs before we even thought of a single person to be a topic chair. We really thought kind of deeply about how we want those committees to look and the overall picture to look. And we were very committed to having people who had a fundamental kind of science research background, yes, leading some of the committees that warranted that, and then having really strong voices in the clinical domain, and a lot of times having them co-chair. So like Kelly said, there were 31 topics, but we have 50 topic chairs. So some of those were partnered for lots of different reasons. The topic was very large, or maybe the topic just was so like transformative, or from, you know, the laboratory to the clinic, that we needed people from both viewpoints in order to have a successful topic. So yeah,
or we needed an SLP and an audiologist.
Yeah. So there were several topics that had SLP and audiology, like leadership and professional issues, for example. We wanted both perspectives, right? We wouldn't just want one. And then the other thing, we really did pay attention to the diversity in many ways. Some of the, you know, more senior friends, more masterful colleagues, paired maybe with a more junior but up and coming rising star colleague, so that we get them in the mix. Or making sure school setting people were, you know, identified and participated. So we really tried from a lot of different angles to diversify that and give a lot of people opportunities.
Yes. And that's hard. Y'all selecting topic chairs and then instilling that in the topic chairs. But then for us to, I mean, I am an extrovert, don't get me wrong, but I'm secretly a closet introvert. And so having to reach out, my social anxiety consumes me. Like the narrative in my head is not always the friendliest, but like trying to reach out and be like, you don't know me. However, you came highly recommended. Click, 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 click. But having that leap of faith that this stranger in this totally different state is going to say, yes, let's join, let's bring that in. Also, folks, the convention committee members don't just have to be SLPs and audiologists. Sometimes we pull in subject matter experts like Dr. Michelle Thierin from FSU, who has been on the podcast, and I geek out her. Y'all, she did a podcast episode on AAC and play and making friends. And I just think that's so beautiful. She's not an SLP, but she is a subject matter expert. And it's kind of like when ASH Foundation gives out grants, not all of the grants are just for SLPs and audiologists. Sometimes they pull in IPP partners. That's what makes our profession beautiful. So there was some topics that was new and exciting. Like I think this year they brought in counseling for the first time. So that was like a new addition for 2024. But was there any topics that when y'all, because y'all have done conventions for years, was there any topic that surprised you that it was a whole topic?
Well, I think one opportunity that Jen and I had in 2022, because we were selected as topic or as convention co-chairs in 2021, we then had an opportunity to serve as topic chairs for the 2022 convention. So we were co-chairs for health literacy, and that was a topic that we retained for the 2023 convention. And that was one that, you know, when we were initially asked, we were asked so that we had an opportunity to work together as co-chairs, you know, on that topic. And they needed one SLP and one audiologist. And I didn't know much about health literacy. And so that has been a topic that I think is so important. And it may be one that over time we see grow and shift as our acknowledgement of the need and the importance of health literacy grows. It may just be something that gets infused into other things. For right now, I think it is important to be a standalone topic because it's one that cuts across the broad disciplines of SLP and audiology, all of our subdisciplines. It cuts across the lifespan and is just so crucial for when we're thinking about how the patients and clients we serve consume the information that we provide them. You know, we're a jargony field, which is not unique to us, but we've got a lot of jargon, a lot of acronyms. And just as a very simple example of ensuring that our patients can read their own reports, you know, not from a decoding point of view, but from a, are we using language that is layperson friendly? You know, is there some access to language that is clearly understood? You know, that's a very, very basic example. But that's a topic, I think, for me that it was new when I served as the topic chair, and it was such a great learning experience. And I was really proud of our ability to retain it and offer it again in 2023. And I'm excited to see how it grows and evolves, because I do think it will be one that in 10 or 20 years, we're like, health literacy used to be its own thing because we didn't just infuse it into everything, you know, the way that the research topic was at one point. You know, I just think I'll be curious to see how it evolves.
Yeah. And on the same note, Kelly, I think I'm right about this. Correct me if I'm wrong. You know, IPE, IPP used to be its own topic too. And I remember serving as a topic chair, I think in LA on that one. But now, because it needs to be infused in everything, it's not its own topic anymore. So like, we'll see things evolve, like Kelly said, as we go. Like, we'll think something's really great and new, and then everyone will just incorporate it. Evidence-based practice, for example, that's not going to be its own topic, right? That needs to be literally in everything. So
yes. Yes. When the terms health literacy started trickling in into our field, that was about the same time I learned about academic literacy. Do y'all know Dr. Michelle Norman? Mm-mm. She's tiny but mighty. She's like literally like yay tall. She was one of my professors many, many moons ago, and she's taught all over Virginia and is now the SLP graduate studies coordinator at Francis Marion University, big involved with MBASLA. But she was talking to me about academic literacy and how first-gen students and BIPOC students may not know how to take full advantages of resources because they haven't been taught that. And it made me fundamentally shift down to how I even write a syllabus, right? And I'm incredibly grateful to her for that. But I feel like with this health literacy component in conjunction with academic literacy, that kind of falls back on faculty to infuse that into all of our coursework. This is what this could look like. Are we code switching from technical to non-technical? And I don't know, just a neuron that I feel very passionate about that we have an opportunity to do something with.
I agree. And I think I'm also first gen, so I'm sensitive to that as well. As you know, when I think about some of the things I thought as an undergrad, like I didn't really know what being an undergraduate student meant, like the term undergraduate. I'm like, when do I become like an upper graduate? Like, you know what I mean? Like, I did not know what's the opposite of that. Like, is it when you become a junior? Is it freshman, sophomore, or undergrad? You know what I mean? I did not know those terms. And what I see now in the undergrads that I do teach is the concept of office hours. So I have office hours and I take time now to explain, because I've had a lot of students not know, it's open office hours, meaning my office door is open during these times, come anytime. And you don't have to tell me in advance, and you don't have to tell me in advance and then tell me later that why you didn't come. Come if you have questions, come any point in time. And there might be multiple people here and you can all be here together. So actually providing that exact description. And that's, I think, a really nice connection to the idea of health literacy and just remembering the things that we do in therapy to support our clients sometimes needs to be applied a little bit more broadly with all of the individuals we interact with, just to make sure that we're communicating clearly and that people can understand our important messages, you know?
Okay. To be honest, I did an associate's degree first because I'm the oldest of five and we had no money for school. And so I at Thomas Nelson Community College over in Hampton, Yorktown, Virginia. And I will never forget, we hit midterms of my first semester and I came home to my dad and I was like, Dad, because my little brothers and sisters, again, there was five of us, were scheduling their parent-teacher conferences. I was like, Dad, when are you going to meet with my teachers? He was like, oh, baby girl. He's like, you're done. We're done with that. If you screw up, you're on you now.
Right.
I didn't know. I naively assumed they were meeting with all of my siblings that, you know, next week they're going to meet with Professor Billy Bob Joe. And, you know, but, I mean, these are the things that you learn when you don't have academic or health literacy.
So I love that example.
I was very crestfallen. Okay. So thank you for entertaining all of the squirrels. Let's get her back on track. Okay. So the next question that I have, and this is something that, you know, I see something on the internet and it makes my heart sad. And y'all, I love my ASHA. I believe in my ASHA because I have volunteered and I've seen the good that it does. So when I see people say, oh, they want our money and they want our dues, I give my monies and then I give extras of my monies. Sometimes Mr. Dawson doesn't agree with that in our budget, but like we do what we do. It's probably why I started color coding things. But anywho, when I see the post, it's implying that we're not necessarily always vetting our topics, our conversations, our presentations, that there's bias in those, what gets approved, what doesn't get approved. And that couldn't be farther from the truth. There is so much work that goes into soliciting diverse featured speakers and so much work that goes into vetting those call for papers. Could y'all talk about that process?
And do you want to say a little bit?
Sure. I was going to say that it is a rigorous process with, I'll just share the details, that every paper that's submitted is reviewed by three people on whichever committee or topic that it is submitted to. And those are rated. And then the topic chair would go through and figure out how many slots that particular topic has and how many can be accepted. So of course, there are ones that are not accepted in every single topic area. And if there is any conflict of interest in any way, that topic chair is asked, encouraged, and actually told to send those on to Kelly and I as co-chairs. And that'll happen next year with the next co-chairs. So if it was your colleague, Michelle, or your friend from undergrad or something, you just get that off your plate and you send it to us for review so that we can avoid as much bias as possible. So we really tried hard, and this wasn't Kelly and I, we didn't invent this. This is an ASHA process and policy that they've had for years.
Yeah.
And I can give two examples of that in action, one of which, a paper that I was an author on in 2022, was rejected. if it doesn't meet the quality, it should have been rejected. So it's, you know, 2022 was a year that there were a higher percentage of rejection rates just because of the space that we had, and also some shifts in the types of presentations that were allowed and movement within those, which we can talk about later. But if it's not up to snuff, it should be rejected regardless of who's the author. So that's one example, and not to say that it should be specific to me, but that is an example. And another one is this year we had several topic chairs who were authors of papers that were submitted to their own topic that they personally had to end up rejecting. And they worked with me and Jen to do so, but they got rejected from their own topic. The topic that they were the chair of, that they built the committee for, it didn't cut the mustard, right? There, it was not reviewed by their peers in a way that was supportive of something that should be presented at a national academic and scientific conference, academic, scientific, and clinical conference. So that happened. It happened enough that I hope it is very well known that this is, it is a peer review process. It is not perfect, but it is rigorous.
Personally speaking, I submitted a call for papers to my topic, and it was a panel discussion, right? Interprofessional panel discussion with some physicians in Boston, a dear colleague who's a pediatrician. But when it ended up being a total of 3 SLPs and 3 physicians, we had to type everything up, disclosures, financial disclosures, non-financial disclosures, bios, everything, and submit it. And then because I am the topic chair, I had to recuse myself of it, send it to y'all and the other committee members, and it had to be vetted to be approved to be on there. So I'm not allowed to vote on it myself. But before it even gets to that vetting process, there's the actual computer program itself will kick out all call for papers if they do not have non-financial, financial, and the bio. And it doesn't even get to us as the topic chairs to then screen. And then we go through and screen to make sure that the paper got submitted to the right one. Because sometimes it gets submitted to PFD, but it was supposed to go to Speech Sounds or something like that.
There is one other level, Kelly, remember this, that it's coming back to you now too.
Oh, yeah.
That we were on it this year, but you're on it as training, like pre-co-chair on the SPEB board. Every single paper that gets accepted by the committee and moves forward is vetted by SPEB. So thousands of them go through there and look at every single thing and make sure that it would be appropriate for CEUs. And always, every year, there's a handful that get flagged at that level after all the other work, and Kelly and I looked at everything, that get rejected. So that's the last review standard. And it's a pretty rigorous one.
Yeah. So that two-layer process is a really important thing. So it's multi-layer, right? Because like you said, Michelle, there's requirements just for it to be like kicked into the review system. And so if disclosures aren't completed, those are required. So that gets kicked out. It doesn't even get sent to reviewers. Every proposal is also reviewed by 3 independent people. So it's possible for one of those reviewers to say, you know, to score it low and the other 2 to score it higher and for it to end up being in the, you know, in a range that's acceptable. The other thing that I wanted to mention too about the reason why something could be rejected, especially if people who are listening have been rejected from ASHA before, is that sometimes it's not about not being up to snuff and not cutting the mustard. It's actually could possibly be that that particular topic curated an invited panel on that topic already. And so we have very limited, and Michelle, I know you feel this, very limited number of hours that we can offer for in-person continuing education time. So not including posters in that, each topic might only have 6 hours to work with. So that can be, you know, 6, maybe it's like 4 one-hour sessions and 1 2-hour masterclass. That is not a lot of time. And so if you've submitted a 1-hour presentation that overlaps or is nearly identical to an invited talk, it might get rejected simply because they only have 4 hours to offer and they're already using one of those for that exact topic. And so there's going to be a presentation on that topic at Asha. And so yours gets rejected, not because it's not good, but actually because it's identical to what they see is needed. And so they're going to make space for something else so that the presentations within that topic are more diverse. So sometimes it's about that too, that it's just redundant. And that should be seen as a compliment that you've submitted something that your topic chair thought was so important. They actually have an invited session on it, but it's also very hard to then, you know, get that rejection, especially if, you know, there's a variety of reasons why someone would want to present at Asha. So it's always hard to get those rejections, but there's a lot of reasons for that.
Y'all did something that I was very appreciative of this year. There was a cap on how many presentations folks could get accepted for. Now, there was some rigmarole because then it became, well, they submitted so many in this topic but they submitted over here and we didn't know about it. But that was, can y'all speak to that? Because that was lovely.
Yeah. So I think one thing we added that I've really liked about that is to make sure we're not only hearing the same voice within a topic, even if it's the leading voice in the topic. We need to hear, like, this was something that we really wanted to, you know, we modeled in how we chose our topic chairs. You guys as topic chairs then use that same approach in selecting your reviewers. And then we ask the reviewers to consider the same thing in accepting proposals, is that it can't all be the same voice within your topic. So that needs to be variable. We also then wanted to acknowledge that there might be multiple voices coming from the similar research lab. And so, you know, I've got 3 doc students as an example. And so when I think about, like, each of the 3 of them could be doing something totally different, and my name is on those proposals as their mentor, but then there's a way to then indicate, you know, that I'm the mentor or I'm the professor. And so that my students aren't judged based on the fact that I'm listed as an author. So there is an allowance for that. But yeah, we also tried to make sure that we're not just hearing the same voices within each topic. And that can be challenging too. But yeah, I think that's an important thing to make sure we carry forward.
Yeah. So I'm hoping that if you're listening, then this has given you a little bit more understanding and a little bit more grace. Because sometimes we can get frustrated just by the lack of not knowing. And we make assumptions, because assumptions are like, I would say something, but it's like an elbow. Everybody should have an elbow, right? My daddy did not necessarily say that G-rated version, but there we are. He has a lot of good wisdom for the most part. Okay.
Well, you know, I think the other thing that I would just tag on to that, I do agree that, but I also want to say that, like, it's certainly not the case that these conversations, even at the level of, you know, I've been very actively involved as an ASHA member since I was in NISLA as an undergrad. I think I was a NISLA member starting in 2001. So, you know, I've been involved in ASHA in some ways very actively for a very long time. And I've been a lot of rooms where a lot of these conversations take place. And these are not easy conversations. And people who are actively involved get mad and think things need to change. And people who are actively involved, you know, really advocate for certain things to change, evolve, and take place. Conversations on these committees can be really tumultuous. And so it's not the case that even within ASHA, people who are actively involved in ASHA are also working towards change. Like, we see what the profession needs. And as a result of seeing that, we're taking action.
Yes.
And so I think that's another important thing, is the taking action part needs to be in the right venue.
Yes. And every January, ASHA opens its call for volunteers. So every January, there's an opportunity to toss your name in the hat. But remember, ASHA can act nationally. It is your state association that acts locally. So join your state association and voice your concerns there too, because they can. It's like ASHA just approved this CPT code for caregiver coaching at the national level, but then each individual state association is going to have to go back and enact that caregiver coaching in their state level CMS manual. And that typically, because we just did this in South Carolina, and even though I'm in Virginia, I'm still somehow, Kelly, I know you're listening, other Kelly, sorry, I know other Kelly's listening. They have to do a fiscal impact study to find out what is the potential financial impact at a state level for adding this new additional CPT code in. They have to tie a price point to it. Then it has to go to legislation and get approved. And there's all of those steps before it can go into the CMS manual at the state. So we have it nationally, but it's that trickle-down effect. Yeah. So, yep. Sorry.
And it's going to be, the way that that's implemented is going to be different in every state.
Yes.
Which is just simply not something that ASHA can do much about.
No, they have national level lobbyists. It is your state association money that you pay to your state association that then pays for your state association level lobbyists, which some states don't even have because so few people have joined.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Ugh. That's a soapbox for a different hour.
A different podcast, and I'd be happy to be on that one.
We'll have a panel, you and the other Kelly. Yes. Hip, hip, hooray. Okay. All right. Scheduling. The chaos of the schedule, because I got to witness that this time. And even though I had three monitors, because my husband's an engineer and his brain can handle three monitors, my eyes hurt. So, like, what is the deal with the schedule? Enlighten, illuminate.
I can start and then Kelly will think of other things. So first, we just have to shout out, like Kelly said from the very beginning, the ASHA staff on this. They are amazing and they do kind of the basic schedule, right? They plop things in. We're talking about thousands of posters, presentations, technical sessions, all happening within like what, 2.5 days, 2 days? So there's only so many hours and then thousands of CEUs. So, and then, you know, you have a massive convention center, the rooms, you can kind of see how many things are in the rooms, like 15 chairs or 500 chairs, but you don't know what the room looks like. You're just doing the best you can. So they do the basic and then we come in and Kelly and I, as co-chairs, were able to invite some people that we thought would care a lot about detail. And Michelle, you were one of them that we invited to help us because you can't do this alone. Like you cannot do this with just Kelly and I sitting looking at spreadsheets. We need a lot of people with a lot of thoughts. And what would happen is like, oh, that might be a good time for that session, but I think more than 100 people are going to come. So we need to move it to a room with 500 people. And then you need to find a room with 500 people and decide, well, are 500 people really coming? Could they move to this other room? So it's really like a huge jigsaw puzzle that takes a lot of people's thoughts to go. And gosh, at the end of the day, of course, it's not perfect. Of course, there's overflow in some. Of course, there's some sessions that we thought would be popular and 10 people come. I mean, that is going to happen every year with this many sessions. But again, I would say, I mean, without the ASHA staff is really fantastic. The ASHA convention team really makes this go forward with all the details. I mean, Kelly and I weren't doing this late at night. You know, we looked at it afterwards and helped solve problems, but that wasn't what we were doing. So it was ASHA. So Kelly.
Oh yeah. I don't have anything to add to that. I agree. It's just imagine like the most monstrous spreadsheet you can, thousands and thousands and thousands of sessions, and then looking at the details to see how many people do you think would attend that based on the title? You know, it's intense.
Yes.
It was probably the most intense part of it.
Yeah. And then making sure that we cross-referenced because there was topics in like PFD, but that same group would also want to go to the craniofacial or topics in adult dysphagia. But those individuals might want to go to this head and neck cancer lymphedema talk. And so there's that layer in. But with the time we have remaining, Kelly, you want to kick us off? What was your favorite memory?
Oh, okay. So I've been thinking about this and it's very hard to choose. And this is going to sound corny and Jen probably already knows what I'm going to say. It's the song we wrote.
Yes, it was so good.
It's so amazing. And so if you guys weren't at ASHA or you weren't at the opening session and haven't seen it, we rewrote We Didn't Start the Fire and made it all, you know, the Billy Joel song. And so kind of this fast paced iteration, all speech pathology and audiology jargon. It's on all of ASHA's social medias and on ASHA streaming. So Michelle, we'll make sure you have the link so you can kind of tag it if people want to watch. But writing that was so much fun. And then we flew to Nashville to record it and we recorded it all in one day, one very long rainy day. And with the most incredible team at Projection who does all of the projection and editing and video work for ASHA and conventions across the country. And then seeing our colleagues' reaction to it at the opening session, I hope to never, ever, ever forget that feeling. It was my favorite part by far.
Y'all, I've never attended an opening session before. I've just never had the opportunity, like flights or something would happen. So it was profound. But Jen, what is yours?
You know, I mean, it's the same because it really was so special. And, You know, I think we got a little sticker. Kelly might have got the same one as a gift. It says, with no risk, no magic. And I put it outside my office door. And I really felt like that summed it up, that we felt really, really risky doing it. I mean, Kelly and I are not singers. Like, we heard each other in the recording studio.
Not great. Oh, God.
You know, we needed a lot of help. And I mean, we picked that song on purpose because it's a little more staccato and talking than singing. And it's just fun. But, you know, we kept that, I guess, behind the scenes is we kept that under wraps and secret from everyone. The only people who knew was a couple people on Asha's staff and projection team. Our colleagues didn't know. The CEO of Asha didn't know. The board of
directors. Asha president didn't know. None of them knew anything about it.
And even when we were rehearsing, there were some students in there setting stuff up. And Kelly and I think I might have been a little hard on them. But you can stay in here if you put your phones away and you promise, like, I want to make you sign something. Do not leak this because it's too good. And then I know we're running out of time, but I will agree with Kelly. You know, we went backstage after introducing ourselves and we said the song's going to happen. And we stood back there with Joe from production. And gosh, Kelly and I remember that feeling, Kelly, just like, I can't tell, like, are they going to like it? And then the first time the whole crowd kind of erupted in laughter, you know, that when we first started singing, I was like, okay, this is going to be okay.
Yes.
It's going to be okay.
It was really, it felt so magical. It was just so cool.
Just so out of, like we said, out of our comfort zone and out of our usual skill set. So it felt risky. So, but I'm so proud of it now. So,
oh yeah. So proud. It was amazing.
Well, I have to thank you both for your leadership, for your time, and for being so giving. So with a whole heart, on behalf of everybody out there, thank y'all for being you.
This is lovely, Michelle. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for today's course. To complete the course, you must log into your account and complete the quiz and the survey. If you have indicated that you are part of the Asha Registry and entered both your Asha number and a complete mailing address in your account profile prior to course completion, we will submit earned CEUs to Asha. Please allow 1 to 2 months from the completion date for your CEUs to reflect on your Asha transcript. Please note that if this information is missing, we cannot submit to Asha on your behalf. Thanks again for joining us. We hope to see you next time.